Please welcome Dr. Orit Markowitz to the stage. Dr. Markowitz is a leading dermatologist, skin cancer specialist, and CEO and founder of Markowitz Medical. She has been called a dermatologic pioneer for her groundbreaking work developing minimally invasive diagnostic and treatment protocols for skin cancer. A fun fact about Dr. Markowitz is that she sang in a band in college and married the drummer.
Good morning, everyone. And I'm going to be presenting this morning on melanoma treatment and staging. So I don't have any relevant conflicts of interest to disclose. And I do want to acknowledge Dr. Kelly Nelson, who is going to be presenting this lecture. And I am using some of her material here today. I am a non-invasive early diagnoser. I do manage things non-invasively. I'm not an oncologist and I'm not managing advanced melanoma, but it is definitely helpful to review and sort of think about when we're looking at our patients, how are we advising them and where are we sending them to if we do get an advanced patient? And so that's where I'm going to sort of focus this lecture, basically as to what I'm doing every day. And I think it probably applies to the majority of everyone in this room as well, if they're seeing patients and screening them for skin cancer. So here, I'm just using some examples of patients that were seen in my office last week. Here's an example of a patient who was coming to see me for hair loss. And I hadn't done her exam since February of last year because she doesn't have a history and she doesn't have any real risk factors. And of course, I think it's important that we'll review risk factors when we talk about melanoma treatment and staging. But she said, you know, Dr. Markowitz, I noticed this lesion on my leg. I know I'm here for something else. Can you take a peek at this? And so, of course, this is what I saw dermoscopically. I said, you know, we need to biopsy this. Let's get this off. And it's a small lesion. And yes, it has asymmetry dermoscopically. And this is what the pathology report looks like. So in pathology, when you're advising patients and you're thinking about melanoma staging and what type of treatment a patient needs, you're looking at various factors such as, you know, what is most important is the depth. Back in the day, we used to look at like Clark's levels. That really does not impact staging or treatment anymore. And so, you know, we're looking now at the thickness, and this was a 0.3 millimeter thick lesion. And then we're looking at mitotic index, and also obviously if there's any evidence of spread of tumor or lymphovascular invasion, et cetera. And that's where we start to place patients in various risk categories. So we have our melanoma. And in this patient's case, even though she's not a melanoma in situ, she sort of falls under that stage 1A because she's under a millimeter in thickness. And the way I describe it to patients, I say, you know, you're about less than the tip of a pencil. Tip of a pencil is about a millimeter in thickness. And so you have a great prognosis. We're going to not need to do any sentinel lymph node biopsy of any kind or further imaging. We can, in our office, we have an optical coherence tomography device. If we wanted to look at the extent or the depth of the melanoma, we could, but for something this small, I don't think it's necessary. And then she's going to go ahead and get excised. But what if she was stage 1A high risk? And I'll go over what that indicates, but basically, you know, what if she had some mitoses to her lesion, or what if She's very young, for example, or what if there was some micro lymphovascular invasion indication? It doesn't change her stage. If she was ulcerated, it would, and we'll go over staging, but these risk factors don't really change the stage of her tumor, but they may put her into a slightly higher risk category. Like what if she was 25? For example. And so, or could she be stage 1B, which also is not, you know, is questionable whether she needs a sentinel lymph node biopsy. And so I find that it's really important that we also take a look at 5 to 10% of our melanoma patients that are not so obvious, because they're looking to us for advice. Like, what are we recommending to these patients? Are we comfortable because they're not stage 1A, they're not stage 0? Do they need a lymph node biopsy? Well, technically it's not indicated. And then of course, if we have the more advanced stage lesions, then yes, we're gonna recommend that they have a lymph node biopsy. But 2/3 of melanoma deaths occur in sentinel lymph node negative patients. So that's 88%. So that's kind of an important number as well. And I'm bringing this up, and I'm sure you've probably familiar, there's also, you know, additional genetic testing that we can do. It is a bit controversial as to how helpful it is, but I utilize it in my practice, so I'm gonna share what I do with you because that's what helps me with my patients. And then if they're class 1A with additional genetic testing that's covered by insurance, then they kind of fall into that category, even if they're intermediary or technically, you know, the stage 1A high risk, et cetera, and I don't worry. But then if they're class 1B2A, then the recommendation is that they actually do see an oncologist and that they can have a sentinel lymph node biopsy. Or now these days, we're using high resolution ultrasound to look at, you know, potential nodal involvement without having to go through the whole procedure. So it would be indicated for these patients. And then the class 2B and up, we have, of course, an oncologist involved. We're gonna recommend all sorts of imaging to look for potential disease. And then they're gonna be candidates for adjuvant therapy, and we'll go over the various therapies for melanoma. So just a quick review on genetic expression profile testing. You're looking at DNA transcription to RNA to proteins, and it helps us not just with invasive malignant melanoma, but even with suspicious lesions. You can actually ask for this testing as well. And now they have the ability for you to look with more invasive appearing squamous cells. And considering we have more deaths each year from squamous cell skin cancer than melanoma, it is important to know that we have some additional profile testing for these lesions. And just to kind of review some of the research that's been done, for patients, let's say, in the Medicare population, it did show that when you utilize these tests, you're going to have less death, basically. And so, again, that's helpful to me because I have a lot of patients who are over the age of 65, and I'm sure if we studied it in younger age groups, we'd probably see the same. So if we can decrease death, that's important. 4.6% versus 7% on patients that weren't tested. So let's take a look at the guidelines on tumor staging. So as mentioned, it's really the depth of a tumor and ulceration that kind of impacts all these staging categories. And when you don't have ulceration, you sort of fall into that 1A category, and you're not sure, do you need to get the sentinel lymph node testing, or perhaps you go for high resolution ultrasound testing to see if there's in transit nodal metastases. So it's nice to have non-invasive options. And you know, that's that 5 to 10% category where you're not sure what to offer the patient. And as mentioned, these are the kind of risk factors. Ulceration and thickness is how we stage, not with Clark's level. And if there's a high mitotic rate or lymphovascular invasion, or maybe the staging is a bit uncertain or the patient is young, then they're at a slightly increased risk. And what do you offer them? And when 88% of sentinel lymph node negative patients are still potentially going to die from melanoma, it's nice to have an additional tool. Here are just very few examples. Here's a young woman with, again, less than a 1 millimeter thick Breslow depth. So basically, she was similar to the patient that I showed you from my practice last week. And she has no other risk factors, and I don't really care about necessarily a Clark's level. No, I know some do. So she falls into that category, but she's young. So technically, she's higher risk. So she was offered Decision DX, and she ended up getting increased monitoring and was sent to an oncologist. And, you know, because her Decision DX was actually at a slightly higher risk category, and they basically were able to find that she needed combo therapy, and on imaging had a metastasis. So that became life-saving for her to have access to genetic expression profile testing. And then here's another example, but this is an older patient, but again, less than a millimeter thick Breslow depth, no evidence of ulceration, so technically doesn't really need any further treatment. She falls into that category of just excise it and monitor the patient every 6 months. But there was a slight risk factor because there was some evidence of tumor infiltrating lymphocytes. She still falls into that 1A category, however. But because her Decision DX was a bit more aggressive, she ended up getting monitored and imaged and was followed by an oncologist. And also, there was some metastases on imaging, so she did better with earlier treatment. So now, let's take a look at some of the genetic testing that we do for melanoma. Not when I say we, not me, but when I'm referring to an oncologist, what are they looking for these patients? Or if I have patients saying, Dr. Markowitz, I have, you know, relatives that have had ovarian cancer, or I have a primary relative with pancreatic cancer, like, what do I do? Do I need to get testing? And that's where germline testing comes into play. And I'm going to say that it's very hard for me to keep up with what is the standard for these patients. So I end up referring, if I hear more than just melanoma, history of cancer, I end up referring to a geneticist, and they can start to advise and do all sorts of testing, because you need to be alert to what is happening with this patient. And you can help identify pathogenic variants that can change screening. And it also impacts their family members. So often they want to know, what do I do for my children, my siblings, my parents? And when you have a primary relative, when you are a primary relative of someone and you have a history of melanoma, they also need to be seen every 6 months, according to the World Health Organization. Somatic testing is basically tumor testing. So here, you're testing tumors the same way we do with other types of tumors like breast cancer, and we're looking for genes so that we can essentially do a better job treating these patients. When I started practicing, we had zero options for advanced melanoma patients. It was basically a death sentence. We had maybe just, we'll go over like the few that we now offer for stage four, but that's pretty much all we had. And now we have so much more that I will review. So historically, with germline testing, the big gene is CDKN2A, but now there are more, right? And the referral criteria, and this already probably has changed, Is that patient with, let's say, 3 invasive melanomas or pancreatic cancer or blood relatives with the same, but there's actually way more extensive referral criteria than that. Currently, there are more genes that we're looking at. Referral criteria is technically a moving target, and this substantially changes management. And now, you know, back in the day, we used to tell our patients, if you have ocular melanoma, there's no relationship with skin melanoma, there's nothing we need to really look at, we send to the ophthalmologist. Maybe some of you, and I do, are recommending that your patients make sure they have eye exams the same way that they have skin exams. One of my first patients was with a history of melanoma, was a young woman in her 20s, and her melanoma was ocular melanoma. So that was kind of altering in the way that I practice. But if you look at the recommendations, they're not technically supposed to be seen more frequently with a skin cancer screening, but I see them more frequently as if they were primary melanoma. And now there are more genetic evidence towards that, so it's not unreasonable, but it's not technically the criteria. And then some of these other newer genes are also now associated with gliomas and cardiac angiosarcomas. And so, like I said, it's a moving target. I'm just gonna go briefly over the classic CDKN2A. As I find that it's helpful to look at these variables. And it's not, there's so much involved in what the geneticist is advising. So it's also that, you know, where do you live? Do you live in Italy or do you live in New York City? Because it also depends on what is the incidence of melanoma in the population. Not just the family history or other cancers involved. And so that's important to think about. And when there is a primary melanoma, there's a 20 to 40% increased high risk for families. I mean, it's pretty substantial. There's earlier onset, so when do you recommend that patients start getting examined? I find that I'm not necessarily telling my patients that their 5-year-old needs to come in for annual skin cancer screenings, but certainly early adulthood, and even earlier if they have risk factors, pancreatic cancer in family members, depending on where you live, is definitely a risk factor. And you know, lung and colon now, and also ovarian. So I leave this up to the local geneticist if I start to hear that there are any of these cancers within family members, that everybody just needs to be examined more frequently. And if they can't get the proper genetic testing, then just see them every 6 months and be a bit conservative about it. I think it's important to remember that genes are risk factors for all skin types. Red hair is an important one, the MC1R, not necessarily that because of the fact that you need to advise your patients and their family members that they do have an increased sensitivity and that they do need to be seen more frequently, and that they have an increased risk of melanoma, and that's in all skin types. And actually, it's even higher in darker skin. And so when you have these classic atypical mole syndrome patients, which is basically greater than 6 moles that are greater than 6 millimeters in diameter, so large moles, and we've seen these patients with atypical moles or dysplastic nevi, they're also at increased risk. In fairer skin patients with this gene, you'll see increased vessels, you'll see the dot globular pattern, you'll see more blue nevi, and with these classic atypical mole syndrome patients, they're at 5- to 10-fold increased risk. So the recommendation is that they're also seen every 6 months. If they have this gene, that's a 4-fold increased risk. So the combination of the two is a 25-fold increased risk. So that patient really, you know, when you have a redhead basically, and they've tested positive for this gene, and they have a lot of classic atypical moles, there's a high likelihood they're going to develop melanoma at an early age. So, you know, very thorough screenings, and you've got to look for amelanotic, is very important. And using dermoscopy, I believe, is important as well in these patients. They're hypopigmented, so for that very fair skin patients, you see the structureless area on dermoscopy, hypopigmentation, vessels, and again, that risk for amelanotic melanoma, and high risk on arms as well, so not just trunk. And then for the darker skin patients, you get the atypical pigmented network, and so again, you know, amelanotic melanoma is independently associated, but with these fair-skinned patients, it's something we're going to look for. And the phenotypic expression, if they have a lot of freckles and you've seen that they've had a lot of sun damage, and even if they have the absence of nevi, but they have this genetic profile, they're also at increased risk. So now let's jump over to therapy. And we look at genetic testing, but specifically the tumor, or this, what we call somatic testing. And here, you're identifying mutations in the tumors. You're confirming with molecular testing, and that's where you have your BRAF, which is also going to be associated with risk factors such as phenotype, like your environment, if you've had intermittent sun exposure at younger ages, and you're going to worry about truncal location, and this is about 40% of all melanoma, so that's a pretty significant mutation. And then you have V600 mutations, which are most responsive to BRAF and MEK, and so these are some of the classic. And then there's the non-V600 mutations with BRAF and MEK. And again, this is not what I'm doing in my practice, but it's helpful to be aware of what's happening when you're referring a patient to an oncologist. You have c-KIT mutations, which we are very familiar with genodermatoses in our pediatric population, but now we're seeing them in certain types of melanoma and also on the more chronically sun-exposed skin. So we know our more aggressive nodular melanomas are associated with chronic sun exposure, as opposed to the more common melanomas, which is the superficial spreading type, which can also become deadly and aggressive, but that's more with the intermittent sun exposure. And then you have exon 11 and 13 mutations with high sensitivity to KITI, and exon 17, and the list is extensive. You have NRAS mutations, and those are correlated with poor survival. So for those patients, often the oncologist is going to want to treat more aggressively. And this is unfortunately in 50% of melanoma subtypes. And some may have these MEK responsive mutations. So this is all of the somatic tumor testing that's being done to try to target or do targeted therapy. So let's go over advanced melanoma therapy. And I think when we do, again, let's take it back to the stages, right? So here are all the various stages in sort of nice illustration that I have a link to in the Melanoma Research Foundation website. But when we're looking at more the advanced tumors, we're wondering, you know, like stage three, there's stage 3A, where you have micrometastatic to 3 lymph nodes, and 3B is 4 or greater, and then 3C is not just to lymph nodes, but also to vessels, and it's metastatic. And then if you have stage 4, where you have your bone mets, your liver mets, and then separately brain mets, which is a whole nother kind of melanoma that needs to be treated differently. So stage 0 is often what I'm catching and focusing on, or stage 1A. And with certain categories of stage 0, and I'll briefly review that, we're actually treating them non-invasively. Why? Because sometimes we get patients that have, for example, a lentigo maligna, which is a stage zero melanoma of the face, and we know that those tend to be less aggressive and take their time, but perhaps might be like this big on somebody's cheek. And so to remove it surgically, you're basically removing half their face. So they may opt for other options, knowing that they're taking a risk while it's a very small percent risk. So we'll review some of that as well. And then the stage 1A or 1B or 2A tumors that kind of go into that intermediary category. Do we do the sentinel lymph node biopsy? I mean, everybody in those stages is going to opt for surgery. We don't have non-invasive really options for them. And then as we're looking at, you know, 2B and C, recently it was recommended that we can provide adjuvant therapy for these patients. I think it's just very recent. And then stage 3, these are the micrometastatic, and you can either do a complete dissection or you can actually use the ultrasound monitoring and just do the sentinel lymph node biopsy if it's negative, right? Because of that 88% patient population. You're gonna have targeted therapy and immunotherapy, which we're gonna go over shortly. And you have finally stage 4, which is you're just gonna have to look at these somatic mutations. And immunotherapy, and basically for stage 4, everything but the kitchen sink, because we want to try to save their lives, so chemotherapy. And when you have brain metastases, there are specific therapies for these patients, like intrathecal immunotherapy, gamma knife therapy, whole brain radiation, and I defer to the oncologist, frankly, to make these decisions, but it's helpful to know what they're deciding and what they're looking at. So now, systemic melanoma therapy for the stage 3. You have immunotherapy and you have targeted therapy. What are the benefits, pluses and minuses? So for immunotherapy, T cells recognize antigens presented, and they're basically targeting outside of the tumor. And the benefit of that is that you get a durable, lasting response, but it does take longer to get a response. And there is sometimes intrinsic resistance and you get pretty severe side effects. Whereas with targeted therapy, which is targeted within various somatic mutations, of course, you have to have the somatic mutation that you're targeting. And it's very small molecules, so the side effects are more limited, but there is potentially a relapse. It doesn't take as long, so you do get, you know, these high response rates, but it's not also as long lasting. And there could be, you know, the adverse events, because you're targeting within a tumor, they pretty much resolve when you stop the treatment. And so here are the examples of the immunotherapy of late that's available, so quite a few. And then here are the examples where you're targeting the c-KIT and the BRAF and the MEK, et cetera. And 30% of the patients in the immunotherapy group will not respond, but of those that do respond, 40% may also develop resistance. So we've come a long way, but it's still quite limited, and it is, as mentioned, a moving target. Now, what's been really exciting is recently the clinical trials on vaccine therapy, or mRNA, right? Because now we have mRNA vaccines that we've been able to kind of work through, for example, in vaccinating for COVID. But we're using the same technology to now help with getting better outcomes for melanoma patients. So these vaccines help your body's immune system recognize and attack cancer cells. Vaccines for melanoma are treatments that work to prevent the recurrence of cancer after surgery. So that's why we're now adding this as adjuvant therapy for earlier stage disease. And the combination of an experimental mRNA vaccine with an immunotherapy recently published just in April of 2023 showed a likelihood of melanoma recurring or causing death decreased by 44% when compared to immunotherapy alone. So this is why, as of very recent, that these criteria have changed. And that's very exciting. And then whenever we think of cancer, we think of chemotherapy, but really here with melanoma, it hasn't always been so successful, but it was the first available. And when you have stage four disease, you're gonna wanna throw everything but the kitchen sink. And so these are the classic examples of those cytotoxic T cell chemotherapy agents. And that's what you're going to be offering these advanced patients, as well as immunotherapy. And recently, they're even taking, you know, they're sort of proliferating the patient's own cells to attack in their immune system. These are all relatively new ways to manage advanced disease because we don't have as many options, unfortunately. And then finally, you also have this melanoma microbiome, which I was not so familiar with. And so hence why I'm acknowledging the original speaker for this talk. But I found the literature to be actually rather exciting because you're looking at the gut microbiome. And we see this often in dermatology, right, with our eczema patients and a lot of other disease states, but now we're seeing it associated with how patients are doing when they're receiving therapy. So for example, if they're getting anti-PD-1 treatment, there's a higher diversity of gut bacteria, and that's gonna be associated with prolonged results. So when we start to lower that with, for example, antibiotics, they were showing that they were actually getting worse outcomes. So a diverse microbiome relates to fiber-fermenting microbes, and you have to be careful when prescribing oral antibiotics to patients that are receiving this treatment. And I'm not recommending this, but the original speaker was recommending maybe that these patients eat more beans. So that might be related to fiber and the microbiome. So how do we help these patients find care? Well, as mentioned, we have regional oncologists. We have designated cancer centers. We can always go on clinicaltrials.gov. That's what I did when realizing that I was going to have the privilege of giving this lecture, to just take a brief look and see how extensive the trials are and how, even just as of, you know, April of 2023, that we're finding, you know, these advances that are helping patients, because often my patients are asking for my advice. Dr. Markowitz, I went to see an oncologist and they want me to go into this trial. What do you think? Well, I can look it up and I can see what are the benefits of that trial, and I can see whether, you know, they have any safety data, or I can even share it with the patient and they can get some knowledge about what they're signing up for. So I think that's helpful. There are specialized centers for brain metastases, so we need to make sure that if they have that that's what they're receiving. And then in my practice, knowing that, for example, you have now the options of non-invasive treatment for, let's say, not obviously the advanced melanomas, or maybe there's some confusion about where, you know, how many lymph nodes are involved, and the patient's asking, should I get a complete dissection? And it's important to know and advise them that they can look at in-transit mets with high-resolution ultrasound. Or if it's a family member, for example, and they have a melanoma that's, you know, a silver dollar on their forehead, maybe just discussing with them that there may be an option, given that it's stage zero and it's a length to go malignant type, that they could try shrinking it or erasing it completely without having to have, you know, a very extensive and quite altering surgery. So I'll go over again, a patient from last week in my practice came in, and here's a lentigo maligna. This patient was coming to see me to have some freckles lasered because he didn't like some of the lentigos, both on his scalp and forehead. And I saw this lesion and I thought, okay, dermoscopically, I'm not comfortable lasering that lesion. I bring up this example for two reasons, not just to go over, you know, the options that, for example, I offered this patient last week or that I've done for a handful of patients in my practice and what is the literature supporting that, but also to remind everyone that it's so important that we remind our patients that if they're going to, let's say you don't have a Pico or Fraxel or, you know, various lasers in your practice to help erase brown spots, and you're saying, oh, you want this done, go to the local, you know, med spa, or here's referring to a colleague that might, and you make sure that you evaluate all of the lesions that you're referring to have treated, because I have, you know, a good number of patients, not a tremendous, but over the years, I definitely have a collection of patients that come in and say, you know, this lesion that I'm going to see my local dermatologist for, she was able to laser all these other ones, but this one she couldn't erase. And I'm like, but that's because it's a melanoma. So we need to make sure we look at things and evaluate them properly. So in this patient's case, you can see that there's asymmetry to this lesion. There's definitely some parts of it that resemble ridges that we see with seborrheic keratosis, but then there's like a little asymmetry. I wasn't, you know, convinced for sure it was a melanoma in situ. I thought maybe there's a pigmented AK, but I'm not just gonna go ahead and throw the Pico on the lesion to erase it. I said to him, I really think I need to biopsy this lesion. And he didn't have time for a non-invasive biopsy, which is a reflectance confocal biopsy. So I said, well, I'm just gonna scrape it. And he was comfortable with that. And that came back as a stage zero melanoma. But look at the size of this lesion, right? So now the patient's asking me, what does this mean? He's coming in for cosmetic treatment of freckles, and now he has, you know, we know that the surgery for this lesion is basically gonna be like really substantial on his scalp. And so he wants to know all options possible. He ended up opting for surgery and had the surgery actually already, which is great. But this is, you know, his pathology, melanoma in situ. And after the surgical removal, I will say it still was melanoma in situ. There was no evidence of any other aspects of the lesion that were more invasive, so that was good. I definitely think if we offer these therapies, even though this is the one pivotal trial that was done in Australia by a very close friend and colleague, Dr. Pascal Guitera, who does a lot of work with melanoma in Australia. And I'm following this protocol if I do get patients who want to be treated non-invasively for these stage zero lesions that are large on their face or their scalp. And it's pretty extensive. The article is listed below, so you can sort of get the same guidance. But basically, they keep a diary. I'm using imiquimod, and patients are requesting treatments for their lentigines. You have to make sure you check these patients. When lesions are resistant, obviously, that's another reason to check, but we know that sometimes melanomas can regress. So some of these lesions that may get treated aren't resistant, and then later they have some metastasis and we never knew what happened, but we certainly wouldn't want that. So again, another reason to make sure you check these patients. Plus, they're gonna be frustrated with you if you are recommending somebody treat them or you're treating them, and then later it comes out that it's a melanoma. The patients need 12 weeks of treatment with imiquimod. There have been studies done with radiation as well, but I'm not offering radiation. I'm offering imiquimod therapy for my patients. And I'm able to monitor them and give them a diary and make sure that they follow certain inflammatory, you need to get a certain amount of inflammation, not too much. And so in the diary, it sort of guides them, and we're able to get their treatment very well tailored. They sign a very extensive consent form that goes over the percentages. And even though they're excellent, there's still a percent that can potentially evolve, and the risk is death, and they have to go into that knowingly. Patients, that's it. And it's also very important, even though in the article they didn't say you had to have reflectance confocal microscopy, but I will say that all of the authors, and especially Dr. Gutierrez, who's a world expert on confocal microscopy, is utilizing non-invasive tools. Now, this is covered by Medicare as a tool to do a non-invasive biopsy. So this is what's being offered in my practice if I'm following these patients, and I honestly don't feel comfortable following them with just dermoscopy, and certainly not just clinically alone. And there could be a patient that's resistant to treatment, but at least you significantly shrink the tumor so that when they do go for surgery, it's a much better outcome. And I've had that patient over the years. So in summary, melanoma staging and therapy, lots of options, definitely based on the various stages. It's important that we are aware that this is rapidly evolving. When I started practicing, pretty much almost everything I presented today was not available. That's pretty amazing. Our stage 2B and C patients are now eligible for adjuvant therapy. Stage 3A patients may not need complete dissection because we have high resolution ultrasound nodal metastasis imaging. Immunotherapy takes longer, but is potentially durable response. The side effects, unfortunately, are irreversible, potentially, and some patients don't respond. And then targeted therapy with these germline somatic mutations is definitely a great option, and the side effects do resolve, and you do get rapid improvement, but it may not last. And be careful when prescribing antibiotics to patients that are receiving these therapies, because the gut flora is actually very important, which is fantastic to be aware of. And there are various resources for identifying care facilities, including clinicaltrial.gov, where you can be, you know, as involved as you want to be in understanding what you're recommending, or when your patients are asking questions about these facilities, and also to be aware that there are places that specialize in brain met. And that's it. Thank you.